Bien, je pense que nous allons commencer la présentation d'aujourd'hui. J'ai le très grand plaisir d'accueillir pour son deuxième cours en professeur invité le professeur Brian Boyd, qui est professeur au département de littérature anglaise de l'Université d'Auckland en Nouvelle-Zélande et qui est un des spécialistes mondiaux de Nabokov, dont il va nous parler aujourd'hui, mais également l'une des personnes qui s'intéresse à la manière dont les sciences cognitives peuvent éclairer l'entreprise littéraire. Et dans le cours de la semaine dernière, il nous avait parlé de la possibilité donc, de comprendre certains des phénomènes de la littérature sous l'angle des représentations cognitives qui sont évoquées dans le cerveau du lecteur, et éventuellement, et on avait discuté, également sous un angle darwinien, en supposant qu'un certain nombre de ces représentations ont été sélectionnées pour leur avantage et que peut-être même la littérature procure un certain nombre d'avantages aux personnes qui la pratiquent. Alors aujourd'hui, today, maybe I will switch to English, we have the second talk, which will be on specifically your competence for Vladimir Nabokov, and still connecting it, as I understand, to cognitive science, trying to see how much of a psychological insight Nabokov had and how this can be reflected in his own work. And before you start on this fascinating topic, I have a little present for you from the Collège de France. This is the traditional medal, which is given to professors. Can bring this home. Oops. Voilà. La médaille officielle avec Guillaume Budet.
Merci.
So, without further ado, Brian Boyd, Nabokov as a psychologist.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back in Paris again this week, and an honor and a pleasure to be at the Collège de France and to be speaking at the invitation of Professors De Haan and Compagnon. I want to talk on the topic of Professor Compagnon's lectures on American literature of the 1960s, which is the course he's running at the moment, and at the same time to be of interest to Professor De Haan and any students in his course on metacognition who may continue to follow me here. Since my own work extends from before prehistory to the present, I have no particular focus on the 1960s, except through the lens of Vladimir Nabokov and through the new glasses that I began to wear as a teenager in those years. I've chosen to talk on Ada, published in 1969, niggling at Nabokov's imagination since 1959, stalled in 1964, revived in a different form in 1965, written in a rush from early 1966, finished in late 1968. So this one novel allows me to cover much of the 1960s. It's his longest, richest, raunchiest, most romantic, and most comic novel. The cover of the first Penguin edition there on the left follows Nabokov's own suggestion, a drawing of a Cattleya orchid, enough said, I think, to a Parisian audience. By focusing on a passage from the novel and Nabokov's explicit and implicit psychology there, I can broach the topic of metacognition. And by focusing on a small passage, a mere 67 words out of almost 600 pages, which I can keep up on the screen, I hope I'll be accessible to those who haven't read the novel. With the thought of the course in the 1960s in mind, let me say that Nabokov did not have much time for literary eras or movements. He thought that the common English expression of the climate of thought was an unbelievably spooky notion. He would have been the last person to want to focus on the 1960s as a special decade of thought. in an unpublished Nabokov lecture that I hope to publish within the next few years, he wrote, "When examining a writer and his work, three points of view interest me above all. Individual genius, the position his work, it's always his for him, the position his work holds in the historical evolution of artistic vision, and the artist's struggle against public opinion and the current ideas of his time." In one sense, Nabokov made a point of this in Ada by setting the novel mostly in the 1880s, but incorporating into it things and people, things that people of the 1960s thought characteristic of their own time: movies, science fiction, comics, Playboy clubs. Ada takes place on a parallel world that matches ours in geography, but not quite in history, so that there are titled nobility and a mix of English, French, and Russian in North America. And of course, this is partly a reflection of Nabokov's own background. There's Nabokov himself, and with his brother there again, with his brother Sergei. This is the estate that he inherited at 16, and where he lost his virginity more or less the same year on those steps. So it's got the world of Europe of the 19th century, but also in the 1880s, swimming pools and Hollywood movies and petrol-powered flying carpets and a ban on electricity, but certainly not on sex. In this sense, too, he was also attentive to the 1960s, using the decade's new freedom to write about sex, to make it a subject of his own poeticized and anachronized treatment of late 19th century hypersexuality, which was also, in another sense, and this is a motif that runs through the novel, straight out of Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights. Nabokov loved to confound categories. Van, the narrator of the novel, and Ada, his beloved, at 14 and 12, are already energetic lovers. They find documents in the attic at Ada's park that help prove that Ada is not the daughter of her ostensible father, but of Van's father, and that Van is not the son of his ostensible mother, but of Ada's mother. Here's the start of the discovery. And just imagine, he's introducing the hero and heroine of a 19th century novel at 14 and 12, naked, just after they've already had sex and before their next round. So quite an exposition scene for a pseudo 19th century novel. And they're about to discover that they're not mere cousins, but full brother and sister. The revelation scene this would be in a standard 19th century novel, except that here they don't care. They simply resume their energetic sexual activity. So this is the first chapter of the novel, not the very beginning of the chapter, but according to the Sunday supplement of a newspaper that had just begun to feature on its funnies page, the now long defunct Goodnight Kids, Nicky and Pimpinella, sweet siblings who shared a narrow bed and that had survived with other old papers in the cockloft of Ardis Hall, the Veen de Marnoff wedding took place on St. Adelaide's Day, 1871. 12 years and some 8 months later, two naked children, one dark-haired and tanned, the other dark-haired and milk-white, bending in a shaft of hot sunlight that slanted through the dormer window under which the dusty cartons stood, happened to collate that date, December the 16th, 1871, with another, August the 16th, same year, anachronistically scrawled in Marina's hand across the corner of a professional photograph in a raspberry plush frame on her husband's knee-hole library table, identical in every detail, including the commonplace sweep of a bride's ectoplasmic veil, partly blown by a parva's breeze athwart the groom's trousers, to the newspaper reproduction. That's typically Baroque Nabokov of Ada. The first sentence there sent me scurrying through the early history of comics for characters with names something like Nicky and Pimpinella. And of course, it wasn't until someone who'd grown up in France in the 1960s and could tell me this was a twisted reference to the hyper-innocent Bonne Nuit les Petits and their Nicolette and Pimpernel that I could understand the joke behind the joke. Mind you, I've since published On the Origin of Comics, so as usual, I've no regret about Nabokov's playful misdirection. Now down to business. Nabokov as psychologist. Vladimir Nabokov once dismissed as preposterous Alain Robbe-Grillet's claim that his own novels eliminated psychology. And Nabokov's response was this: the shifts of levels, the interpenetration of successive impressions and so forth belong, of course, to psychology, psychology at its best. Later, when he was asked, are you a psychological novelist? He replied, all novelists of any worth are psychological novelists. And since he evidently did not consider himself a novelist of no worth, we can safely infer that he saw himself as a psychological novelist. Psychology fills vastly wider channels now than when Nabokov, in the mid-20th century, refused to sail the narrow course between the Scylla of behaviorism and the Charybdis of Freud. It deals with what matters to writers, readers, and others, with memory and imagination, emotion and thought, art and our attunement to one another, and it does so in wider time frames, incorporating evolution and with tighter spatial focus than even Nabokov could imagine. It therefore seems high time to revise or refresh our sense of Nabokov by considering him as a serious and, of course, also a playful psychologist, and to see what literature and psychology can now offer each other. I offer no definitive chart of the terrain, just prompts to exploration. We could move in many directions. A fact itself, a tribute to Nabokov's range and strengths as a psychologist. The writer as a reader of others and himself, and as an observer and an introspector, in relation to the psychology that he knew from fiction, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Proust, Joyce, and from non-fiction, from professional psychology, William James, Freud, Havelock Ellis, as a psychological theorist in his fiction and his non-fiction, and as a psychological experimenter in his fiction, running thought experiments on the characters that he creates and on the effects he produces in readers. We could consider him in relation to the different branches of psychology in his own time and now: abnormal, clinical, comparative, cognitive, developmental, evolutionary, individual, personality, positive, social, and in relation to different functions of mind, whose limits he happily tests: attention, perception, emotion, memory, imagination, and pure cognition, knowing, understanding, inferring, discovering, solving, inventing. In relation to different states of consciousness: waking, sleeping, dreaming, delirium, reverie, inspiration, near-death experience, death experience. And we could consider what recent psychology explains in ways that Nabokov foresaw or all but ruled impossible to explain. He used to tell his students, the whole history of literary fiction as an evolutionary process, and he doesn't mean in a Darwinian sense, simply in the course of its development, may be said to be a gradual probing of deeper and deeper layers of life. The artist, like the scientist, in the process of evolution of art and science, is always casting around, understanding a little more than his predecessor, penetrating further with a keener and more brilliant eye. As a young boy, he desperately wanted to discover new species of butterflies, and he becomes no less avid as a writer for new finds in literature, not only in words, details, and images, in structures and in tactics, but also in psychology. He declared that next to the right to create, the right to criticize is the richest gift that liberty of thought and speech can offer. And he himself liked to criticize, utterly undaunted by reputations. He especially liked to correct competitors. He was fascinated by psychological extremes, as his fiction testifies. But he deplored Dostoevsky's, quote, monotonous dealings with persons suffering from pre-Freudian complexes, unquote. He admired Tolstoy's psychological insight and his gift of rendering experience through characters. But while he availed himself of Tolstoy's techniques for scenic immersion, for making us feel that we are living the scene with the characters, he sought to stress also, almost always, the capacity of our minds to transcend the scenes in which we find ourselves. Nabokov admired Proust's capacity to move outside the moment, especially in untrammeled recollection. But he also allotted more space to the constraints of the ongoing scene than Proust. In his novel, his last Russian novel, The Gift, he gives Fyodor, the narrator and hero, some of Proust's frustration with the present. But he also locates amplitude and fulfillment even here in the present for those who care to look. And where Proust emphasizes spontaneous, involuntary memory as in restoring our links with the past, Nabokov stresses memory as directed by conscious search. He revered Joyce's verbal accuracy, his precisions and nuances, but he also considered that Joyce's stream of consciousness technique gave too much verbal body to thoughts. The medium of thought for Nabokov was not primarily linguistic. We think not in words, but in shadows of words. Thought was for him also multisensory, and at its best, multi-level. As cognitive psychologists would now say, using a computing analogy completely foreign to Nabokov, consciousness is parallel, indeed massively parallel, rather than serial, so cannot translate readily into the emphatically serial mode that a single channel of purely verbal stream of consciousness can provide. Famously, Nabokov could not resist deriding Freud, and for good reason. Freud's ideas were enormously influential, especially in Nabokov's American years, but his claims hollow. Nobel laureate Peter Medawar, perhaps the greatest of science essayists, declared in terms akin to Nabokov's that Freudianism was, quote, the most stupendous intellectual confidence trick of the 20th century. Nabokov saw the intellectual vacuity of Freudian theory and its pervasiveness in the popular and the professional imagination. He thought it corrupted intellectual standards, infringed on personal freedom, undermined the ethics of personal responsibility, destroyed literary sensitivity, and distorted the real nature of childhood attachment to parents. And these, I think, have all been amply confirmed by modern developmental psychology. Nabokov treasured critical independence, but he did not merely resist others. He happily imbibed as much psychology as he could from the art of Tolstoy and the science of William James. He also looked for himself. He was a brilliant observer, not only of the visual and natural worlds, but also of the world of human nature. We can see his acute eye for individuals throughout his letters and memoirs, and in others' recollections of his sense of them, even many years later, and of course, in his fiction. So let's turn there now to the fiction, to one short passage, as I said, a mere 67 words. I want to interweave the psychology that Nabokov observes and experiments with in his fiction and the modern psychology about whose possibilities he was so skeptical. I also want to show just how much psychological work fiction can involve, or how much Nabokov's swift shifts make it involve. In Ada's fourth chapter, we see Van Veen at his first school, the elite River Lane, and at his first sex, with a young helper at the corner shop, a fat little wench, whom another boy at the school has found can be had for a Russian green dollar. The first time, Van spills, quote, on the welcome mat what she would gladly have helped him take indoors. But at the next mating party, he really began to enjoy her soft, sweet grip and hearty joggle. And by the end of the term, he's enjoyed 40 convulsions with his girl. The chapter ends with Van leaving to spend the summer at Ardis, the manor of his aunt, in fact, his mother, Marina. And this is the final paragraph of chapter 4. In an elegant first-class compartment, with one's gloved hand in the velvet side loop, one feels very much a man of the world as one surveys the capable landscape, capably skimming by. And every now and then, the passenger's roving eyes paused for a moment as he listened inwardly to a nether itch, which he supposed to be correctly, thank log, only a minor irritation of the epithelium. Log, by the way, is a play on the Russian word bog, meaning god, and it's logos, as the god of anti-terror, the world on which this whole novel takes place. Nabokov writes fiction, not psychology, but this typically exceptional passage depicts and appeals to psychology. These lines and psychology have much to offer each other. The elegant first-class compartment and the gloved hand make the most of a cognitive bias, the contrast effect. Our minds respond to things much more emphatically in the presence of a contrast. Through the suddenness of the switch van and VN, contrast the tawdriness of the fat wench possessed among crates and sacks at the back of the shop with the opulence of the train and van's fine dress. One feels very much a man of the world. We can all recall and imagine sudden moments of self-satisfaction, especially at points where life steps up a level in childhood and adolescence. We can unpack this several ways. Life history theory and recent evolutionary biology focuses on species-typical patterns of development and their consequences across species. Although before life history theory showed our human life patterns in a comparative light, we knew the importance of and the unique delay in the onset of human sexual activity. Psychology long neglected emotion. Now it explores even the rather complicated social emotions, like those associated with status. Taking a step up on the staircase of life marks a rise in status, and recognizing that boosts levels of the neurotransmitter serotonin in the brain. This rise, in turn, if you're past puberty, raises the inclination to sexual activity, as in Van on his way to Ardis, who wakes up there early the next morning to, quote, a savage sense of opportune license, when in his skimpy bathrobe he encounters the 19-year-old servant Blanche. In one's gloved hand, one feels very much a man of the world as one surveys, much less common, of course, in English than the French on. Van invites us to a common human emotion through the generalizing pronoun one. We take this appeal to shared experience for granted. Recognizing shared experience and wanting to recognize it are at the basis of fiction and the social life that fiction feeds on. But psychology should do more than just take these facts for granted. It should help us to explain them. Mirror neurons discovered in the 1990s fire in the same part of the motor area of my cortex that would be activated if, say, I grasped something when I merely see someone else grasping something. This unforeseen component of neural architecture, especially elaborate in humans, helps us to understand and to learn from others, and both to cooperate and to compete with them. We also have, from infancy, a far stronger motivation to share experience than have other animals, even chimpanzees. Think of an infant's compulsion to point, to draw others' attention to something just possibly of interest. This heightened motivation to share experience seems to lay the foundation for human ultrasociality. We understand the actions of others when we see them by partially reactivating our own experience of such actions stored in our memories. But more than that, we also attune ourselves to others' actions and empathize with them, unless we perceive them as somehow opposed to us. Over the last 15 years, psychology has begun to study the remarkably swift and precise ways we attune ourselves rapidly and often unconsciously to what we see in others. Van and Nabokov appeal here to our shared experience, to our recollection of our pride in reaching a new stage in life, like learning to walk, starting school, or here, mastering the rudiments of sex. Research in grounded cognition in recent neuroscience shows that thought is not primarily linguistic, as many had supposed, but multimodal, partly reactivating relevant multimodal experiences in our past, involving multiple senses, emotions, and associations. Just as seeing someone grasp something activates mirror neurons, even hearing the word grasp activates the appropriate area of the motor cortex. Our brains encode multimodal memories of objects and actions, and these are all partially reactivated as percepts or concepts come into consciousness. Nabokov rightly stressed that imagination is rooted in memory. Indeed, that was the very point of his entitling his autobiography, Speak Memory. Since the early 1930s, it has been known that we store episodic memories, memories of our experiences, as gist, as reduced summaries of the core sense of an episode or the feel of a situation, rather than in terms of all the surface details of the episode or the situation. Our stored knowledge of past situations and stimuli allows us later, as it were, to unzip the compressed file of a memory and to reconstruct an image of the original. Recent evidence shows that memory's compression into gist evolved not only to save space on our mental hard drives, but also to make it easier to activate relevant memories and to recombine them with present perception or imagination of future or other states not experienced. If memories were stored in detail and the details had to match exactly, mental search would be slow and rarely successful. But once memories have been compressed into gist, into a whole series, as it were, of mental keywords, many memories can be appropriate enough to a new situation or a new imaginative moment to be partially reactivated, as it were, according to these common mental keywords or search terms. Minds evolved to deal with immediate experience, and although human minds can now specialize in abstract thought or free-roaming imagination, we still respond most vividly and multimodally to our immediate experience. For that reason, more of our multimodal memories can be activated by language that prompts us to recreate experience as fiction does, rather than more abstract, less personal, less sequential texts. Nabokov was right to insist on the power of the specific in art to stimulate the imagination. Here, he and Van appeal to the groundedness of cognition through their use of details like the velvet side loop and the gloved hand to activate our multimodal memories of the look and feel of gloves, velvet, and side loops in trains or cars. So far, I've stressed how these first few words appeal to what we share in experience. But despite its appeal to what what we share, the passage also implies different kinds of distance. There's the distance between Van as adult narrator, as by this stage we already know him to be, despite his third-person presentation of Van as character in this passage and in much of the novel. The distance between Van as adult narrator and his writing in his 80s and 90s, and Van as a 14-year-old feeling himself very much a man of the world. The word one, which generalises from his situation, as if adolescent Van can now grandly sum up a new truth that he's reached from his lofty vantage point of experience, can only seem absurd to Van many years later, after much more sexual exploration than a few furtive convulsions with a shop girl. As a nonagenarian narrator, he can see a 14-year-old's pride in his experience as proof of his past self's relative innocence. But that distance between Van as character and Van as narrator also sets up something for us to share with Van as with Van as narrator. We've all reflected, ironically, later in life, upon satisfactions that had seemed robust when we first felt them. We see here how memory compression into gist may help us retrieve a whiff of similar episodes that we've experienced or witnessed. But apart from this multiple appeal to what we share, Van, and especially Nabokov behind him, also know that his way of wording his recollection will also establish a different kind of distance between Van and reader. Many readers never travel first class, and few males, however elegant, now wear gloves on a summer's day. Van, in his elegant first-class compartment with his gloved hand in a velvet loop, has a strong element of dandified self-consciousness mingling with his pride at being very much a man of the world. The generalising pronoun one, which on one level invites readers to share a common experience, on another also discloses Van's intellectual pride in arriving at a new generalisation and his foppish indulgence in his sense of superiority to others. The upper-class English use of one applied to oneself, seen as a mark of high-toned speech, reinforces the snobbery that amplifies Van's self-satisfaction and complicates the appeal to our identification with him, although we too will recognise moments when we felt superior to others. We're not far into this passage yet. Let's move on one clause. One feels very much a man of the world as one surveys the capable landscape, capably swimming by. Here, Van and VN comically evoke our human tendency to see the world through the tinted lenses of our emotions, or even to project our emotions onto what we perceive. Capable applies legitimately only to agents. Van and VN absurdly apply it to the landscape, and then adverbially to the way the landscape skims past Van's train window. Narrator and author know the comedy of twice misapplying the term, which suits only Van's sense of himself to the landscape. Nabokov suddenly confronts us in this surprising, vivid, ironic, amusing way with an instance of our human tendency to project our emotions onto the world. Psychologists study this kind of projection through priming in terms, say, of what we notice or think first if we've been primed with, just exposed to, either positive or negative emotional images. Yet despite the comedy of Van's emotional priming, Nabokov and Van also appeal to our imaginations through our memories in that landscape skimming by, as we've all seen through train windows. Well, we're hurtling along now at the last sentence already. And every now and then, the passenger's roving eyes paused for a moment as he listened inwardly to a nether itch. Van and VN, activate our own multimodal memories and awareness, our proprioceptive sense, our awareness from inside of our body positions and sensations, of the ways our eyes move as we attend to an inner discomfort or pain, and our memories of others glancing sideways in thought or hurt. The surprise and yet the naturalness of the metaphor listened to another itch. Trigger our multimodal activation, roving eyes, inner ears, touch, of multimodal memories of monitoring our inner sensations. And perhaps they also arise out of the synesthesia that Nabokov rendered so exactly in Speak Memory that his description has become a classic of synesthesia studies. Synesthesia, I presume you know, but just in case you don't, it's the hearing of sounds, say speech sounds or music perhaps, in visual terms, in terms of colour, or other crossovers from one sensory mode to another. Very well explained by you, I must say, Stan. But Van, attending to this nether itch, supposed it to be correctly, thank Log, only a minor irritation of the epithelium. We're invited to infer that Van has a few momentary worries about a venereal disease that he could have contracted from the fubsy pig pink haulet at the shop near his school, and that sometime later, when the itch does not recur, he confirms to himself it had been no cause for alarm. Nabokov stresses the importance in the development of modern fiction of writers learning to trust readers' powers of inference, because we prefer to imagine actively, to see in our mind's eye much more than the page spells out explicitly. We intuit Van's concern through our familiarity with his context, because we now share that common ground with him. We know he's had 40 convulsions with this shop girl. Things don't have to be spelled out for us in this paragraph to infer the whole situation. And that successful inference further confirms our sense of the ground that we share with Van. Van's unfounded fears of venereal disease may add another note of comedy, but they also prepare us structurally both for first, the romance of love and sex with Ada at Ardis, which is going to begin in the next chapter. That's where Van's train is taking him. A romance highlighted by contrast with the schoolboy lineup for page six that we've read earlier in this chapter. And secondly, the tragic aspects of Ardis as a sexual paradise, not least in the venereal disease that through Blanche, the servant girl, enfolds itself into the romantic myth of Van and Ada at Ardis. This brief paragraph, immediately accessible, immediately evocative of multiple senses, emotions, and memories, typically embodies a multiple awareness of Van at 14 on the train, of him a little later that summer when he can feel sure that he's not caught a venereal disease, of him as a much older narrator, recalling his young self and inviting his readers to sense what we share with him, but also to recognise young Van's cocky sense of what makes him privileged and apart. As narrator, Van evokes and reactivates the experience, yet he also sees himself from outside, and every now and then the passenger's roving eyes paused. Psychologists distinguish between a field and an observer relationship to an experience or a memory, an inner view as if amid the field of experience, and an outer view, observing oneself as if from outside. Ordinarily, we experience life in the field condition, but precisely because we can compress memories into gist, we can also afterwards recall our experience as if from the outside, as in the radical recombinations of our memories in our dreams. As we read, we also tend to toggle or glide between imagining ourselves within the experiences of a focal character, Van seeing the landscape swimming by or listening to his nether itch, and an outer view, seeing Van with gloved hand in the velvet side loop. A number of times in his works, Nabokov makes explicit one of his personal psychological observations about the casual, insignificant impressions suddenly locked into permanent memory when they happen to be caught in the forehaze of a major change in one's life. Here he doesn't refer explicitly to the forehaze, but that's what he portrays. Van, unaware that his visit to his cousins, as he thinks they are, from which he doesn't expect much, will transform his life, and of course will cast an entirely different light on his pride in being a man of the world merely because of a few paid orgasms with a fubsy harlot. As rereaders of this chapter, and Nabokov always packs enough into his mature fiction to entice us back to reread, and the rereading is an even richer experience than the initial reading. As rereaders, we can be highly conscious of the structural role of this scene, of the contrast between Van in the shop with the pig-pink wench and at Ardis in passionate embrace with Arda, or between the cheap harlot earlier in the chapter and the fancy whores that he resorts to later when he's away from Arda, or when he flees Ardis appalled at her infidelity, or between the harlot and the comically fleeting anxiety about venereal disease that she causes Van, and the venereal disease that Blanche, the prime celebrant of the romance of the venery at Ardis, tragically passes on to her own child, who's born blind. Ardis' complexities and charms invite multiple rereadings, and rereaders can sense all these multiple contexts surrounding the immediate scene. We also seek to explain anything unaccounted for by its local or its larger context. I had laughed at the capable landscape capably skimming by, but to my shame, never felt it problematic. But a group of Japanese academics who meet in Kyoto to read Arda once a month recognize something in the conjunction of capable and landscape that anyone who knows the English 18th century well should recognize. Van and VN allude here to the greatest of English landscape architects, Lancelot Capability Brown. He used to arrive at a new property and say, well, this has capabilities. And of course, this is particularly appropriate since Ardis, where Van is headed, is an 18th century estate whose grounds display the kind of gentle naturalness that Brown introduced between earlier English formal gardens and later romantic preferences for the wild and the sublime. I find the fact that Van and VN smuggled this illusion in and that I didn't see it, but that it was eminently discoverable, very funny. Nabokov loves the psychology of attention, of memory, of discovery, and of humour. On rereading, we can be aware not only of what we now know, but also of what we were being led to expect or being mentally and emotionally prepared for on a first reading, or what the author has devised to work one way for first-time readers and more richly still for rereaders. We're immediately aware here of Van as 14-year-old character and less vividly but still consciously aware of him as mature narrator looking back with amusement but also with pleasure at his young self and of the intricate combination of appeal to shared experience and proud Van's sense of his own specialness. And after discovering the hidden as well as the overt joke in Capable, we can also recall our discovery of the illusion in our state of innocence before the discovery. We can be aware, therefore, of all these multiple times and levels. Van, here in June 1884, a few weeks later, when he can be sure he's picked up no disease from the shop girl, recalling this in later life, and at the moment of writing this, Nabokov behind Van Veen, and readers first time and recalling train journeys that we've taken or stages in life that we've triumphantly reached, rereading and placing the scene in relation to Ardis, and even expert enough to see the landscape architect hidden in the landscape. Think how different this is from our experience as readers of Tolstoy characters on trains. In Tolstoy, we seem to enter immediately into the minds and experiences of the focal characters, because he conjures up all the relevant elements of the situation, the physical presence, the personalities of those involved, the interactions between them, and relevant information about their past relations. Our imaginations seem contained entirely within the scene. We feel ourselves within the space that the characters occupy. But Nabokov prefers to evoke and exercise our recognition of the manifold awareness of consciousness. The different vans here, character now, character slightly later, narrator much later, felt from inside or seen from outside. The different appeals to recognize what we share and what holds us at a distance from van. The awareness on rereading of the appeal to first-time readers and to our accumulated knowledge of the rest of the book on rereading. Our awareness of specific puzzles that we can now recognize as puzzles because we've seen the solution. Tolstoy also builds up scenes gradually, coordinating characters' actions and perceptions. Nabokov speeds us into the railway scene without warning, without explicitness, only first-class compartment, side loop, skimming, and passenger specify the situation, without lingering, too, that the scene ends as soon as this paragraph does, and without spelling out the when or where until we infer them at the beginning of the next chapter. He has confidence in our pleasure and imagination, inference, and orientation. Clinical, comparative, developmental, evolutionary, and social psychology over the past 30 years have devoted a great deal of attention to theory of mind and to meta-representation. Theory of mind is our capacity to understand other minds, or our own, in terms of desires, intentions, and in the human case also of beliefs. And meta-representation is our capacity to understand representations as representations, including the representations that other minds may have of a scene. While some intelligent social animals appear to understand others of their kind in terms of desires and intentions, only humans have a clear understanding of others in terms of what they might believe, in fact, their beliefs effortlessly into their inferential systems. By adolescence, we can readily understand 4 degrees of intentionality: A's thoughts about B's thoughts about C's thoughts about D's. As adults, we start to make errors with, but we can still manage sometimes 5 or 6 degrees of intentionality. Our thoughts as rereaders say about our thoughts as first-time readers, about Nabokov's thoughts, about Van the narrator's thoughts, about Van's thoughts at Ardis, about Van's thoughts on the train to Ardis. Nabokov finds fascinating the multi-level awareness of the mind, and he actually worked to develop it in himself and his readers and rereaders, as he discusses most explicitly through Fyodor in The Gift. Fyodor deliberately sets himself exercises of observing, transforming, recollecting, and imagining through the eyes of others. Frustrated at earning his keep by foreign language instruction, he thinks what he should be really teaching was the mysterious thing which he alone, out of 10,000, 100,000, perhaps even 1 million men, knew how to teach. For example, multi-level thinking. The very idea of training the brain in this way, as Fyodor does for himself, as Nabokov learned over many years to do for his readers, fits with neuroscience's recent understanding of brain plasticity, the degree to which the brain can be retrained, fine-tuned, redeployed. Play has been nature's main way of making the most of brain plasticity over millions of years. It fine-tunes animals in key behaviors like flight and fight. Hence the evolved pleasure that animals take in chasing and frisking and in rough and tumble fighting, nature's way of ensuring that they'll engage in this training again and again. in my recent book on the origin of stories, I look at art as a development of play and as a way of fine-tuning minds, in particular cognitive modes that matter to us. In the case of fiction, our expertise in social cognition, in theory of mind, in perspective taking, in holding multiple perspectives in mind at once. As I made that case in On the Origin of Stories, for once I wasn't thinking of Nabokov, but he takes this kind of training of the mind, perception, cognition, emotion, memory. Hope I've got the last page here. One of Nabokov's characters, Panine, goes to give a lecture and discovers when he's taking out the text that he's brought the wrong lecture. At least I haven't done that. As I was making the case on the origin of stories, I wasn't really thinking particularly about Nabokov, but I do think on reflection, on coming back to Nabokov, that he takes this kind of training of the mind, of perception, of cognition, of emotion, of memory and imagination more seriously and also more playfully than any other writer. I've used one brief and superficially straightforward example from Ada to show how much psychological work we naturally do when we read fiction, and especially when we read Nabokov's fiction, and how much light psychology can now throw on what we do naturally when we read fiction. Literature's aims differ considerably from those of research psychology. Nevertheless, literature draws on human intuitive psychology, which itself is also a subject in recent psychology, our natural intuitions about how our minds work, and exercises our psychological capacities. Literature aims to understand human minds only to the degree that it seeks to move human minds. It may move readers' minds in part by showing with new accuracy or vividness, or at least with fresh particulars, how fictional minds move, and by showing in new ways how freely readers' minds can move given the right prompts. Psychology, too, wants to understand minds, both simply for the satisfaction of knowing and also in order to make the most of minds, to limit mental damage or to extend mental benefits. It uses the experimental method. We can see fictions, too, as thought experiments, experiments about how characters feel, think and behave, and about how readers feel, think and behave, and how they can learn to think more imaginatively, feel more sympathetically, act more sensitively. Fictions are experiments whose results will not be systematically collected and peer-reviewed, and then perhaps read by a few psychologists, but will be felt vividly by a wide range of readers. Nabokov thinks at their best, art and science meet on a high ridge. Psychology, after wandering along wrong paths to the Freud Falls or the behaviorist barrens, has just emerged onto that ridge. Nabokov may have doubted psychology could crest this particular ridge, but I think he's met science there. Thank you for your attention.